This KPCC podcast is supported by Center Theater Group, presenting Something Rotten, called The Funniest Thing Since the Book of Mormon. The hit musical comedy begins November 21st. Tickets at AmundsenTheater.org.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. Wherever you are in Southern California, or listening on our podcast, your favorite place to get podcasts, I'm with critics Leah Lowenstein, Tim Cogshell, and Charles Solomon. We start this week with Justice League, the DC superheroes together in this all-star assemblage. Ben Affleck, Gal Gadot, Jason Momoa, Ezra Miller, Ray Miller in the cast, Zack Snyder directed, and the screenwriters Chris Terrio and Joss Whedon. Tim, what'd you think of Justice League?
Well, you know, this is interesting. I went to see this movie twice. I do that sometimes. Saw it at the sort of regular critic screening. Went to see it late last night at the Landmark. Because I just wanted to, you know, sometimes
see it with a regular audience.
Yeah, I don't always trust what's going on, you know, when I'm with a whole bunch of, I love you guys, but you know.
No offense,
not necessarily representative of the larger population.
So last night I go to see this movie, which I was a little lackadaisical on, first time out, right? It's a very serious movie. So, you know, Zack Snyder. And Zack takes these things very seriously. You know, they're very dark and all this kind of stuff. Not, he doesn't have that light touch that some of the other filmmakers who've made some of the Marvel movies have made with these same characters. And this one is a little bit darker. But on the other hand, Mr. Wheaton had a hand in this film, too, wrote the script and actually came in and did some directing chores.
Yeah, he co-wrote. Well, he was given a credit for co-writing it with Chris Terrio.
Yeah.
And I think you do see Joss Whedon's hand in this because there are some scenes where, well, he was brought in to do some reshoots and you can see some of the lightness in the interaction of the characters.
That has to be him.
Mm-hmm.
That just has to be him. And that's when the movie works. As you're watching the movie, you have these little moments where this movie's like pretty good. I'm kind of enjoying this. It's not. Then there are these moments where it becomes very serious and very self-important. And that's Zack at work. And it made for a sort of discombobulated film for me. But I tell you this, in that room last night with fanboys and fangirls, they were having an absolutely fabulous time.
Yeah,
they were right smack dab. And a true weak point of the movie to me is the villain. It's just another generic sort of
Steppenwolf
from the dark side. He's a character from all of the, you know, he's just a generic big CGI, this, that, and the other thing.
He reads Hermann Hesse. How sophisticated can you get?
One of the things that I like about the whole concept of the all-star superhero gathering is it does lend itself to humor because you can play with the characteristics and how they interact with each other.
Yeah, like Ant-Man and Iron Man.
Great example.
And those are the moments where I think the film does kind of sing. I mean, there's this lovely interaction between the Flash and Cyborg, and they both realize that they're sort of the accidents, that the accidental superheroes, the ones who weren't born with the abilities. And there's a lovely and there's a fun little interplay between, like, you know, between Batman and Wonder Woman, and you know there's some sort of crackling chemistry there. I really enjoyed in particular seeing Gal Gadot again. I love her as Wonder Woman. I think she brings the most kind of pathos to this movie and the moments where it felt the most alive. I agree with you, Tim. I thought the big set piece action scenes were big, blustery, loud, kind of too much. You can't always figure out where someone is. It's confusing in the editing. And frankly, it felt a little long in those moments. The movie itself is a couple of hours long, full 2 hours. But the moments when the superheroes do get together, and we've got Aquaman, we've got Flash, we've got Cyborg, we've got Batman, Wonder Woman, and possibly somebody else, you know, that's where it's fun.
It's interesting that in the superhero action movie, the best moments are had in dialogue, not in the action.
Yeah.
The best moments are when they're talking, walking around,
well,
doing
stuff. That gets back to the script you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Or when they just, you know, refer to each other by their first name, or they know things about each other, or they understand things.
Henry Cavill has done something to his body that's just insane. If he's not Superman, for no reason whatsoever, he spends about 10 minutes with no shirt on. Other than, I mean, I know the reason.
Yeah.
It's a good 10 minutes. He looks fantastic. That's just crazy.
Justice League is the film, the latest superhero movie out this week, directed by Zack Snyder. It's rated PG-13 and in wide release. The animated movie The Star, directed by Timothy Reckert, Carlos Kotkin, and Simon Moore are the screenwriters. Charles.
Hey, Billy. I have no idea who the audience for this film is supposed to be, and I don't think the filmmakers did either. It's essentially the story of the Nativity retold by a bunch of wisecracking comic animals. The film opens with the Annunciation. The angel is just this sort of vague blue light. Instead of the poetry of the Magnificat, some of the loveliest poetry in the Bible, Mary's response is, "Thanks. Do I say thanks? You know, why not text OMG? Angels say I'm going to have SOG. The main character.
We've got Kristen Chenoweth as her only witness to this, a mouse.
Yes. Yeah. A mouse that's in the background has seen this. The main character is a donkey who's tired of grinding grain and wants to walk in some unexplained royal procession and ends up being the donkey that carries Mary to Bethlehem. Was, of course, also the subject of The Small One years ago from Disney and a knockoff direct-to-video.
And Nestor, the long-eared Christmas donkey, I think, among other things. This time he's Bo. He's known
yes.
as Bo.
It's not funny enough to work as a comedy and be silly because the animation is not very good. It's weightless. The slapstick isn't timed properly. And it's too silly, I think, for religious parents to want to say, oh, here's something we can take the kids to at
for
Christmas.
For the Bible story.
Yeah. So I just didn't get it.
I think for religious families, it might actually work as some sort of Christmas time entertainment. But it you're right. It's not very good. It's sort of brings me back to the whole era of frenetic animal comedies that I'm glad we've gotten over. I thought you're right. Yeah. Mary seems to take it all in stride. Joseph wasn't even that upset about the whole thing.
And he's also too young.
He's way too young. There's supposedly this whole rivalry between Joseph and the donkey, which doesn't really work. It's very odd. The camels are kind of funny, or the three wise men, but you kept wanting more. It's the fact that it's trying to make it this sort of chase between King Herod's henchman and the three wise men.
Henchman who looks like something. He looks like Boba Fett helmet.
Yeah.
And the camels, one of them is Oprah Winfrey, and they're trying to be the hyenas from Lion King. There's also a lost sheep who wants to be Dory from Finding Nemo, and it just don't work. Mm.
The star not so bright in the sky for our critics. The animated film, directed by Timothy Reckert, rated PG and wide release. Wonder, based on a best-selling book, stars Jacob Tremblay, Julia Roberts, and Owen Wilson. Stephen Chbosky is the director and co-screenwriter. Lael?
So this is I think a fairly faithful retelling of the best-selling book, and it's about a child with facial differences who is sent to a mainstream school after having been homeschooled for a long time by his mother, and the challenges that he faces there. Some of it is all kind of we've seen this before: the fish out of water, the new kid in school having to deal with teasing and abuse and so forth. But it's on a much bigger scale here, obviously, because Augie Pullman Tremblay does look so very different. He has these very serious genetic deformities that have caused him to have 25 surgeries, and he is quite affectingly portrayed by Tremblay, who was the boy in Room, so good in the movie Room.
Yeah, he was good
and
in that.
Even though he's here under layers of prosthetics, you still get what makes this kid special. Like he really feels very real, and his emotions feel very real, and he's able to act. You can actually see his eyes through the prosthesis, and great supporting cast. I would say Julia Roberts, very strong as the mother, Owen Wilson as the kind of wisecracking father, David Diggs as a teacher, like a really strong cast. And it does break into the structure of the book where different characters have different perspectives. It's a sweet, heartwarming, touching, affirming, positive movie. Also, lovely performance by Mandy Patinkin. It's a little little treacly. It's a little treacly, okay? There's some treacle.
I sense a dissenting note.
Jeez. Oh, you're such a cynic. Okay, what?
The movie bored me numb. And you're right about the performances. All of these.
What about the story?
I saw this movie in 1977 when it was on the ABC After School Special.
Which one? You know, Boy in the Plastic Bubble?
All of them. Okay. They were all the same.
It did feel a little familiar.
What was that film with Cher?
Mask.
Yeah, I thought
all of that. And yes, it's all, and it just bored me numb. It bored me numb, except for those moments when it was occasionally deeply moving, particularly toward the end. And Owen Wilson, he's standing around in these skinny suits with his hands on his hips, making these goofy dad faces, you know, and like, oh, your mom's not going to like that. And he'll just go, doesn't seem to have a job. Nobody in this movie seems to have a job. Do these people work anywhere? Anyway, it's, you're right, all your description. But it's just so crazy, crazy boring. And it's,
I think it's more just a little treacly than, you know, there is a message. Let's not throw out the message.
Kids are mean.
Yeah. And let's do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Wonder is the film. Stephen Chbosky, the director and co-screenwriter. It's rated PG in wide release. Mudbound stars Carey Mulligan, Jason Clarke, Jason Mitchell, Garrett Hedlund, Mary J. Blige, and Rob Morgan. Dee Reese, the director and co-screenwriter with Virgil Williams, based on Hilary Jordan's novel. Tim?
An absolutely wonderful, deeply moving, woeful film. Very woeful. You know, I sometimes I find myself kind of poking at these movies that exist in a narrative that I like to call this like through line of the slave narrative that, you know, doesn't just involve slave movies, sort of works its way through all of the things that sort of happened to the black community across Jim Crow and through Reconstruction and all of that sort of stuff. And generally speaking, though these movies can often be very good, they leave me feeling worse rather than better. About me and my community and all of that kind of stuff. I wrote a piece about Detroit not long ago. This movie has to approach that territory, but it knows something. Dee Reese, who wrote and directed Pariah and Bessie for Queen Latifah on HBO, and this is adapted from a novel by Hilary Jordan. It's a very, very good book that I happen to have read, too. It's also sort of schematic, broken into these segmented stories. It's basically about a black family and a white family, basically. In the South, just before and just after the war, these families have these two sons. The black family sends their eldest son to the war. The white family sends their younger son to the war.
The war we're talking about is World War II.
World War II. Mm-hmm. The black son is a tank commander, and the white son is a fighter pilot. This experience shapes them into different people than they were when they left. And when they come back to the Deep South, they can't come back the same way. I think we know this narrative in a certain way. But I love what this movie does. Carey Mulligan's character. Each one of these characters has a voice, literally a voiceover in the film where they tell their story. Carey Mulligan's character is a sort of city gal who, when she's 30, marries into the family, into the white family, and goes down south to work the Mississippi Delta on that mud farm down there. The black family are tenant farmers on that farm. Tenant farmers, not sharecroppers. That's a different thing, right? This movie knows that that's a different thing, and I just love that. And then we have these stories that flow out in these voices. It's all so true and so real. It's an ensemble in the truest nature of it, the music. The sound of the South in the Mississippi on a summer night is all over
this
movie.
Could you smell it?
Oh my gosh. You could smell it.
I know that smell.
There's nothing like that. You could feel the mud. You could feel the air. I mean, this was a very tactile film. I mean, it was very visceral.
Even when we're in the war, because we're with that tank commander when he's in those tanks, and that's a feeling and a sound. And when we're up in the sky fighting those, that all of it just expertly done. And then this movie does something that most of these movies don't do. It finds humanity in most of these people. It lets the evil lie where the evil lies, because there was evil in some of these folks. But it finds humanity in most of these people. And I just love that about this movie.
Humanity in some.
Most of these people.
Not all. For me, I thought this was a really stunning film. It's like visual poetry, and one of the best, perhaps if not the best, ensemble performances I've seen all year. Mary J. Blige also gives a terrific performance as the mother in the African American family, and just
she's really quitting herself as a strong actor.
Really, really good. Yeah, it's very. There are parts of this film that are you just want to look away because it's so hard to see, but it's. My God, it is so relevant to what's happening now in our country. This is, you know, it's set 70, 80 years ago, but it's this is now. I mean,
the dynamic
this
of those
kind
relationships,
of,
Mary J. Blige and Carey Mulligan's character,
yeah.
These two women.
Yeah.
You know, who it's there's a thing that goes on in this movie that's just extremely knowing and extremely sophisticated and will just not let you off the hook in those easy, easy ways.
Yeah. Mudbound is the film. You can see it on Netflix or on the big screen. Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, Lemley's NoHo, North Hollywood, and the Landmark in West L.A., Mudbound, rated R. We'll be back with more film reviews in 1 minute.
Mashup Americans is back with a brand new season, and we are pumped to be back with the fam. Listen as Randall Park learns about his dad's bachelor days, and Maz Jobrani remembers the strangeness of being both American and Iranian in the 1980s. We also have a Cambodian refugee talking to her daughter about the joy of discovering a pair of awesome bell-bottoms at the food bank, and we rediscover the flavors of San Givens past and present. We laugh, we cry, and we ask really awkward questions. Hear the future of America right now. Subscribe at applepodcast.com/mashup and get us in your ears weekly. Ciao.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Charles Solomon, Tim Cogshell, and Leo Lowenstein. Our next Film Week screening series event, Saturday night, December 16th, theater at Ace Hotel, and Die Hard for the holidays, our special screening that Saturday night. I hope you'll join me. Tickets are available at kpecc.org/in-person. Die Hard, Saturday, December 16th, 7 o'clock, theater at Ace Hotel. I hope to see you there. Next up on Film Week, The Breadwinner, which is an animated film set in Afghanistan. Nora Toomey is the director. Anita Duran is the writer of the film. Charles, what do you think of The Breadwinner?
I think this is one of the, if not the best animated film of the year. It is from the Cartoon Saloon, the people who brought us Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea. Both Oscar nominees. There's no drop of quality here.
Both gorgeous films.
Both gorgeous films, as is this one in a very different way. This is a story about an adolescent girl in Taliban-dominated Afghanistan. When her father is taken away by the Taliban, she has to cut her hair and disguise herself as a boy to support her family. Her mother and older sister cannot go out by themselves under this regime. They cannot earn a living. They can't even shop. So she has to become the breadwinner to sort of keep up her courage and to amuse her little toddler of a brother. She starts telling a story of the fight against the Elephant King. And this is done in a completely different style, whereas most of the film is drawn in a very muted palette and very understated animation. The adventures she's recounting are done in CG to look like cutouts with a much brighter palette, bolder animation, louder performances. This is the world that helps keep her sane while she's dealing with these harsh realities of her life. You know, at a time when we've had a call for greater diversity, for greater roles for women in film, directed and written by women, about a girl's struggle in a repressive world, it is a lovely, moving film.
And it's based on a novel written
yes,
by a woman, Deborah Ellis.
Yes, an adolescent novel.
Wrote the source material for The Breadwinner. Tim, what did you think?
Exciting and thrilling without being frenetic. Charles and I often talk about these movies that we watch where it's always moving, never stops talking. It's just not that. There are quiet passages in this film where no one says anything, where the characters are asleep and we watch them breathe. And when it does get brutal, they very smartly move away. Most of that happens orally, right, Charles?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You don't see it, but you hear it.
You see a visual, like a cue.
Yeah, as you would out of the corner of your eye. Mm-hmm.
And that's just very, very clever. You know, they won't shy away. The Taliban, this regime, worked in a certain way and did certain things, and we want to represent that. But we're not trying to scare anybody. So, yes, very, very sophisticated, very, very, very good, outstanding film.
I find with these cartoon saloon films, like Kells and Song of the Sea, I get very emotionally mm-hmm. moved by
oh,
these
yes.
films. Lael, do you find that?
Absolutely, Larry. This is one of the most powerful films of the year, I think, and one of the best animated films that I've seen. It was so, wow. I mean, talk about a scrappy heroine who has to think for herself and face horrible obstacles. Talk about, you know, a family like having to overcome hard times. Talk about, you know, even explaining the Taliban to children. I'm not sure I would recommend this film for young children, but certainly, you know, maybe older children. It was absolutely eye-opening and ironically taking place in, you know, the Middle East after just having seen that dreadful The Star. Like, I'm thinking, wow, this is such a different take and such a really real, very, very affecting,
do you find
beautiful
an irony,
moving.
Lael and Charles, and that this is a movie about a little girl playing a little boy, and the little boy she's playing doesn't really act all that much like a boy. In an American movie of the same thing, the little girls are little girls, but they act like boys.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this little weird.
Look, she doesn't know how to be a boy.
No.
You know, this is very alien to her, and it's also very frightening. If she's exposed for masquerading, she could be beaten. She could, you know, her family would have horrible repercussions for them. There's so much riding on her very narrow shoulders.
And it does give a little introduction to the history of the region and to Taliban rule and what happened then, and explains that, you know, just for being a girl, you know, once she hits adolescence, she is punished for being in public, for being not covered. That's what's remarkable.
No, she should not be educated. She shouldn't even be out with her father.
Yeah.
The Breadwinner is the animated film from the Irish studio Cartoon Saloon, who also did the tremendous animated films The Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea. The Breadwinner is directed by Nora Toomey, written by Anita Duran from Deborah Ellis's novel. It's rated PG-13. It's at the New Art in West Los Angeles. Denzel Washington stars as Roman J. Israel Esquire. Colin Farrell co-stars. Dan Gilroy, the writer-director. Lael?
I think this film was not quite as good as it really could have been. Washington, of course, is always fantastic, and he brings it again here to this performance as a rumpled attorney who was sort of the man behind the man in a two-person law firm, who never litigated publicly in court, who is somewhere on the spectrum. He's got some social issues, and he's not really comfortable dealing with other people, but he's a savant. He's got this brilliant mind and this photographic memory, and when his partner has a heart attack, Roman has to figure out how to cope in the world, and takes a job with Colin Farrell, who's quite a shark in his fancy suits, and he's kind of a slick guy who bills, you know, $1,000 an hour and all this, and somehow Roman is taken into that firm because of his brilliant memory, and he's brought into these cases that he. Well, it's sort of a world that he shouldn't really have gotten too steeped in. And to me, there's connective tissue that's missing from the film. I think things were cut out of it. Things may have been moved around that make it a little bit hard to follow. There's some interesting things about it in that it takes some unexpected turns, but it didn't move me as much as I wanted it to.
I love the idea of someone on the autism spectrum mm-hmm. being the protagonist mm-hmm. of a film like this. Tim, what did you think?
And that is what anchors. Lael's correct about everything to do with this film. I actually like it quite a lot, but I can see the problems. There are all kinds of problems here. This film has more in common with films like Injustice for All and Prince of the City, those sort of
overheated legal.
Exactly,
yeah.
Where everything just gets so big and operatic.
Big,
it's almost like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And this film goes there, but by putting him on that spectrum, you give him a reason to be that way, to sort of lock into these things and make these grand speeches, because he's really on the spectrum. He doesn't know that he's doing these things. He will start crying for no reason whatsoever, just bawling. Because people, you know, at certain spots on the spectrum, the emotions are out of... But he's quite brilliant. And then he runs into this young woman, Carmen Ejogo's character, who is also an activist. And that's what these are. He's an activist, and he's been working his whole life. He's been working on this legal brief to make the world right. And when this sort of Johnny Cochran-esque mentor of his dies, he's afloat. He's adrift. I like Colin Farrell's character in this film because he's a shark. He's every bit the shark that you say he is, Lael, but he can see Roman. He can see Roman, and I like that about him.
Roman J. Israel Esquire, the film starring Denzel Washington and Colin Farrell, Dan Gilroy, the writer-director, rated PG-13 at the Arclight Hollywood and the AMC Century City. The Swiss drama The Divine Order is written and directed by Petra Volpe. Lael?
Wow, this is another film that I really loved this week. I'm so glad we're getting into the good season because it's just the hits just are coming and coming. This is the Swiss Oscar entry, it is, although it's set in 1969-70 in a small town in Switzerland, it could not be more relevant to today. So as the rest of the world, or at least the U.S., has been swept up in the women's lib movement and, you know, female emancipation and all that, this little sleepy town is left far behind. Our protagonist, Nora, is a dutiful wife who never even thinks to question her role in life when, little by little, things happen that cause her to. For one thing, there's a movement to get the women's right to vote on the ballot in Switzerland. In order for that to happen, this entirely patriarchal, male-dominated society would have to vote for women to have the right to vote. And so with that as sort of the crux, the conflict, you know, how to get that to happen, Nora, no accident, I'm sure, that she's named after the heroine of A Doll's House. Begins to awaken. She has to go to a town to look after her friend's runaway daughter, and there she discovers some literature that introduces her to Betty Friedan and so forth. She awakens. It's a funny, joyful, delightful, moving, and terrific comedy. Love this movie.
I love that it's about men. Men have to do something here. But I got to tell you, I did not know that women in Switzerland did not receive suffrage until 1971. I actually got into a fight with my sister about this like 5 years ago. She told me this.
I said couldn't be true.
I told her she was making it
shocking.
Up. Yeah. And this film is about that. First of all, that's shocking. But I liked that in this film, ultimately, the men are called on the carpet. Mm. The women know what needs to happen.
Yeah.
And they have to force the men to behave.
The men have to transform a little, too.
Yeah.
Stars Marie Leuenberger. It's written and directed by Petra Volpe. Unrated movie, The Divine Order. It's Switzerland's official entry for the Oscars at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Wait for Your Laugh brings us a 94-year-old Rose Marie, the co-star of The Dick Van Dyke Show, played a comedy writer Sally Rogers in that classic film. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking with Rose Marie as well as with Jason Wise, the director of the film. Charles, your thoughts on this documentary?
There were a lot of things about Rose Marie I didn't know. I knew her from Dick Van Dyke and from there had been some very early Fleischer cartoons that featured her when they were doing things with jazz musicians. It's a very interesting story. And while she's on the screen, it's really compelling. Even at 94, she just grabs you.
She's got it, and
she's got your interest and you don't want to look away. The weakness of the film is that they try and recreate some moments from her past. Mm. As a little girl, she walks out of the theater and met Al Capone, whom she got to know. He was Uncle Al to her. But to have somebody dressed up in a 30 suit with a cigar being Al Capone sort of lets all the air out when they've gone to such trouble to find archival footage of her on the stage, on the screen, on TV, what looked like her home movies of from the show. And they're all more interesting.
Lael?
Yeah, I'll agree. She was the most interesting part of the film. And when she's talking about episodes from her life, that is fascinating. I would have liked to see a little more about her talking about her vaudeville days and the fact that she was basically sort of forced into child labor. Her father took all her money.
Which is not uncommon for child performers
of
that era.
And, you know, how did she feel about that? I mean, she just sort of had to accept it. I mean, there's some interesting things there. I think that the film, for me, brought up a lot, maybe more questions than it answered. But I thought, as an introduction to Rose Marie, whom I mostly knew from the Hollywood Squares, I thought it was pretty elucidating.
Yeah, the mobster stuff, I had no idea.
Right?
And that Evelyn Nesbitt, the stage actress, had given her the name.
Oh, yes.
That was
Yeah, she was a huge star.
I when she's on the screen, it's fantastic. Very traditionally made documentary film with all the elements that you would think. When she's on the screen, it's fantastic. I like that she talked a lot of smack in this movie about Capone. She's calling the boys, all those gangsters. Yeah, the boys, they're great. They were great. Love the boys. I love that. Just really neat.
Wait for Your Laugh, the film featuring Rose Marie. Jason Wise is the director. It's at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, where tomorrow night, or I should say Saturday night show, will include discussion with the director, Jason Wise, and Dick Van Dyke and Dan Harmon. Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. will also show the film Lemley's Town Center in Encino. The film features Rose Marie, Dick Van Dyke, Carl Reiner, and others who worked with Rose Marie over the years. Jason Wise, the director, and I'll talk with Jason and with Rose Marie coming up right after our break. Wait for Your Laugh is Unrated. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We come your way twice over the air, Fridays at 11 o'clock, Saturdays at noon as part of the brand new KPCC lineup. But remember, you can subscribe to it. Your favorite place to get your podcast is there for you every week.
This KPCC podcast is supported by Center Theater Group, presenting Something Rotten. With 10 Tony nominations, including Best Musical, the New York Post says Something Rotten is a big, fat hit. This hilarious new show tells the story of two brothers who are desperate to write their own hit play, while the rock star Shakespeare keeps getting all the hits. When a local soothsayer foretells that the future of theater involves singing, dancing, and acting at the same time, the brothers set out to write the world's very first musical. With its heart on its ruffled sleeve and sequins in its soul, New York Magazine says Something Rotten is the producers plus Spamalot plus the Book of Mormon squared. Begins November 21st. Tickets at AmundsenTheater.org.
Rose Marie, my generation of baby boomers, knew her as one of the stars of the Dick Van Dyke Show, but she was a star singer from the vaudeville stage beginning at the age of four, continuing on to play the biggest clubs from coast to coast, as well as Vegas in the very earliest years through its development. Now the new documentary that opens today in Los Angeles tells the life story of Rose Marie, Wait for Your Laugh. We're not only joined by Rose Marie, but the director of Wait for Your Laugh, Jason Wise. It's wonderful to have you both with us today on Film Week.
Oh, it's an honor.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Rose Marie, let me start with you and your response to seeing 90 years of entertainment, that your career in a film like this. Is it exciting when you finally saw the movie?
Oh, of course. I mean, I really didn't know what I did. I just kept working and working and went from one thing to the next. That's all. That was my job.
Well, take us back to your earliest years. In the film, we hear baby Rose Marie at age four, like a little Sophie Tucker. You sounded like an adult.
Well, I sounded like I do today. That'll stop you right there.
And you're...
No, I sang exactly like I do today, or I did when I was 3 years old. And my mother loved show business, and 14th Street in New York was like the 42nd Street of today. And she used to take me to see all the shows and everything. And I would come back to the apartment, and I would do them everything I saw. I'm not an impressionist, but I used to imitate everything I saw. And the neighbors said, I would say, I have to go sing for the neighbors. And I would go sing for them, and they ended me in an amateur contest. In New York, I was about 3 and a half years old.
And became a huge star of the vaudeville stage.
Well, that was because I had been heard, excuse the expression, a child wonder, and NBC had heard about it and asked me to come up, and they did, and they signed me to a contract.
Well, so you were heard coast to coast.
Affiliated with RKO, and I had my own radio show when I was 5 years old, coast to coast. And
amazing.
Everybody wrote in and said, that's not a child, that's a 45-year-old midget. No child sings like that. That's not a child. Well, NBC, as I said, was affiliated with RKO. So they sent me across the country and doing vaudeville to prove I was a child. So that's where I got my vaudeville experience.
One of the things I love, Jason, about your film of Rosemary's life and career is you show the joy that she had in performing, despite the fact that she was her dad's meal ticket, and you know, there was a lot of pressure on this girl to support her family, but she clearly loved to perform.
Yeah, I would say that the thing with Rosemary is there's very little complaining. As long as she gets to do what she loves, and that is perform, seriously. I mean, she wants to see an audience react to her, and she wants to deliver a great experience to an audience. And you see it from really the age of 3 to this moment now. I mean, even when I interviewed her, she's in her stories. Is she going, are you entertained? Are you liking this? I mean, it's that's what her mission is.
Yes, we are.
Exactly.
Yeah, because she still got it at 94. Very entertaining presence. We're pleased to have Rosemarie join us, the actress and singer, star of the Dick Van Dyke Show, the Doris Day Show after that. You've heard her voice in right up to a Garfield animated program just a few years ago. The new documentary, which is out at a couple of the Lemley theaters and the Egyptian Theater, Wait for Your Laugh. Also wanted to talk a little bit about all the materials you got your hands on for this, Jason, because you've got films, home movies, all kinds of stills, behind the scenes things. Where'd you get all this?
Yeah, so this is a very unique movie in the fact that it starts with nitrate film from the 1920s and ends with computer animation. It's a very, very interesting scope. And through the process of making this, I was working with Rosemarie to see if we had the story I believed. And she said, I know what might help you. I've got all this behind-the-scenes footage, color footage my husband and I shot, on the Dick Van Dyke Show, Gunsmoke, started naming all this stuff. Would that help you for your documentary? And my jaw hit the floor. And so Rosemarie, who saved virtually everything over the course of her career, provided us with an absolute treasure trove of American, just Americana. I mean, never before seen treasure.
Rosemarie, I was amazed at all the stuff you shot. That was just, you just wanted to document your career?
No, just did it for fun, for laughs, Come over to the house, we'll show you some movies,
Yeah.
It wasn't anything intended. I just did it to keep a memory of it for myself.
And now you're sharing it with thousands of people. How do you feel about everybody seeing all this behind-the-scenes stuff?
I think it's wonderful. I can't tell you how thrilled I am about this movie. And Jason, even though he's there with you, I must say he's just about the greatest thing that ever happened. He's going to be the biggest man in this business when this thing gets out enough and everybody sees the work he does. It's genius. Even Carl Reiner, he said it's the greatest thing he's ever seen.
Well, and Carl Reiner's seen...
has raved about it.
He's seen a lot in his 90-plus years. Carl Reiner, by the way, is featured in the documentary. Dick Van Dyke is featured in the film as well. So many prominent people who worked with her over the years or who have been influenced by the work that Rosemarie has done. It's Film Week on KPCC. We're talking about Wait for Your Laugh, the film. Let's talk about your marriage, because a love story is a central part of this film. The great trumpeter, Bobby Guy, who you lost an untimely young death in the mid-1960s. And share with us how important he was in your transition from a young woman performer into being the full multi-talented adult performer you became.
I can't answer it. It just happened. I met him, and I knew 3 days after I met him, I said, that's the man I'm going to marry. And my girlfriend said, are you crazy? You just met him. She says, you don't go out on double dates. You don't want to do this. You don't want to do that. You meet this guy and you're going to marry him? I said, yep, I'm going to marry him. You only know him 3 days. I said, I don't care. And I did marry him. And I had one of the most beautiful marriages that ever happened. The expression soulmates really applied to us because we were unbelievably happy and cherished the whole thing with a beautiful daughter.
And your daughter, Georgiana, is featured in the film as well. And we get to see from your husband how close you two were. I can't remember his call, Reiner saying that he was always there on the taping day for the Dick Van Dyke Show and just tremendous support for you on the program.
Rose, he was very prominent in his own way. I mean, he was Bing Crosby, first trumpet player. He did all the top television shows, did Guys and Dolls and a lot of movies. He was a top man in this business. It was really, I was really very, very proud because, you know, everybody used to say, she's making a lot more money than him. He'll be called Mr. Rosemary. He never was called Mr. Rosemary. I was always Mrs. Guy, and I was the proudest of that.
And what's so great is that he clearly took pride in your work and was so comfortable with you being the big star, and yet he was so acclaimed in his field at the same time.
He just fit in like a glove. He did things that I couldn't do, and he took care of everything that I couldn't do. He was unbelievable. I'm telling you, the title soulmate is used very easily. But he was really there for you.
We'll continue with Rose Marie and the director of Wait for Your Laugh, Jason Wise. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. This is Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to talk with Rose Marie, the gifted performer. First as a child singer, no one believed that this big Sophie Tucker-like voice could come out of this little 3-4-year-old girl. She went on to a national NBC radio program from there, toured the country at major theaters as she grew up, performing year after year. And then as she added comedy to her performances as she got older, she garnered attention from an agent, came to Hollywood, and the rest is TV history as well. Feature films, but of course her long-running role, Sally Rogers in the Dick Van Dyke Show, and then the Doris Day Show as well, and many other performances. But you might wonder, how did she get just a first name as her performer name? That wasn't something that was done back when she started out. Well, from Wait for Your Laugh, she describes that.
Rose Marie Guy, and I said, no, just Rose Marie. He said, don't you want a last name? I said, just Rose Marie. That's what everybody knows me by. He said, nobody knows you out here by that. I said, they will. It's just Rose Marie. I was the first one to have a one-name thing. Now there's Cher, there's Liza, there's everything. I was the first one.
Boggled my mind, Jason, in the film, it's disclosed that she was given her name by Evelyn Nesbitt. That's how far back her career goes.
Right, yeah. This film is full of absolutely now kind of unknown important American stars. And Evelyn Nesbitt at the turn of the century was one of the most, oh boy, salacious, most interesting, and very talented women. And yeah, she's the one who gave her the name Baby Rose Marie.
I could not believe that Evelyn...
I sing with her.
Yeah,
and she said to my father, what's her name? And my father said, Dainty Rose Marie. And Evelyn Nesbitt said, why don't you call her Baby Rose Marie? And that's how that started. Well, I kept Baby until I was about 14 or 15. It was a little awkward at that age. So I said, how about Miss Rosemary? So it was Miss Rosemary until I finally grew up to be an adult and do my nightclubs and things like that. And when I came out to California to start to do television, I went to the agent and I said, I want to go to work. And he said, okay, Rosemary Guy. I said, no last name, just Rosemary. He said, just Rosemary? I said, just Rosemary. I went from Baby to Miss to just plain Rosemary. And that's the way that happened.
I mentioned about how she transitioned from singing to comedy. Let's hear about how her nightclub routine evolved over the years. This again from the film Wait for Your Laugh.
No female was doing comedy at that time. Nobody. And little by little, I was doing comedy in my act, singing, and getting more and more into comedy. My reviews opened up with, she's someone to be reckoned with. This young lady with the beautiful gowns and the gorgeous hair and all this and all that. She's a hell of a performer. I couldn't write a better review. I couldn't write one.
And were you always a funny person, Rosemarie?
Well, I think so. I know the definition of comic and comedian. One says funny things, and one says things funny. And I think I'm one of those people. I'm just a nut.
Let's talk about you come to Hollywood, and you get cast in the Dick Van Dyke Show. I also found out from Jason's film that you were the one who brought Maury Amsterdam to the show, and you just had incredible chemistry with him in those writing room scenes.
Well, as I told you, I've known Maury since I've been 11 years old, and we've always been very close friends. In fact, I'm his daughter's godmother. That's how close we are. And he used to write all my material when I was doing comedy in the nightclubs and the different, you know, gatherings. He used to write my material because he wrote beautifully. He was a very funny man. He was known as Mr. Jokester. Anyway, when I got the thing at the Desilu for the Dick Van Dyke Show, I never went to audition or anything like that. When I got there, Sheldon Leonard said to Carl Reiner, if you want the best, get Rosemarie. So I never auditioned or I never did anything. I had the part when I was there. And I said, who have you got for the third writer? And they said, we haven't picked him yet. I said, what about Maury Amsterdam? He knows every joke there is, and he's a great joke man. They said, well, do you know where he is? I said, I'll call him in New York. He's in Yonkers. But when I got the call for the show, they said, this is for the Dick Van Dyke Show. And I said, what's a Dick Van Dyke?
Because no one really had heard of him at that point.
No, not at all. And when I called Maury, I called him in Yonkers, and I said, you're going to come out to the coast. I said, they're going to put you in a show called the Dick Van Dyke Show. Maury said, what's a Dick Van Dyke?
And you both learned.
I'm going to do the show.
But you saw that he couldn't just tell jokes. You thought he'd be a good actor because he is a good actor in that show.
I just knew that. I just knew that because I've known him, as I said, since I was 11 years old.
We're talking with Rosemarie, the co-star of the Dick Van Dyke Show for its acclaimed run, the Doris Day Show after that. Also a voice you've heard in animated features, film star as well. But it all began as baby Rosemarie, the singer, on stage when she was 3-4 years old, just a little baby, belting out the songs. Her whole life story is told in the new documentary, Wait for Your Laugh. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A., Lemley's Town Center in Encino, and the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Jason, when you started contacting people to interview for the film, like Dick Van Dyke, Carl Reiner, and some of the others, how anxious were they to talk about? Because, I mean, they're pretty candid, particularly Carl Reiner's case, that he thought Rosemarie was a little demanding to work with.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, Rosemarie, she wasn't demanding with me to work with, but I can say I love you, Rosie, but I could see that being the case. I think Carl was a little apprehensive at first because, you know, a lot of people when you contact about a documentary like this, they want to know, what are you actually making? Is this a tribute movie? Is this something that's just going to be kind of a canned thing? And I tried to explain to Carl, I'm trying to make an honest thing. And Rosemarie gave us full-blown permission to make a good, honest, don't lie, don't make something soft kind of movie. And so, yeah, the interview started with him thinking we were making kind of a tribute thing. And then he and I sort of hit it off, and it became a very long, open conversation about the Dick Van Dyke Show was not the completely sunny, wonderful world that I think it's portrayed to be. I mean, the first season was a virtual, complete, and total flop with a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. And everybody was scared for their jobs and working very hard. And Carl was happy to say that. But what happens in the film is America starts to fall in love with Mary Tyler Moore. They shift the show more towards her. And, of course, Rosemarie was very upset about that. And that is one of the things we touch on in the movie. And Carl definitely talks about it.
Well, for whatever it's worth, Rosemarie, my favorite moments of the show were in the writer's room. And I always wanted to see more of you and Maury Amsterdam. Rosemarie.
Well, thank you. That's very sweet.
It's been a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations on a remarkable 90-plus year career.
Thank you very much. It's so nice talking to you. Give Jason a hug for me.
All right. We'll see how he feels about that. Jason Wise is the director of Wait for Your Laugh. Rosemarie at the center of it. Her life story is told in the film. Again, at the Lemley's Royal, Lemley's Town Center, and the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Thank you so much for joining us for another edition of Film Week on KPCC. We remind you, we come your way every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon right here on 89.3.